I lost it already. Okay. I'll call to order the General Government, Consumer, and Small Business Protection Committee. Colleagues, today is Wednesday, February 9th, 2011. We are convened for the purposes of introducing some committee measures and then having an informational meeting on how our biggest state agencies are doing on both, you know, the percentage of their contracts that are going to Oregon-based companies, also hearing the percentage of their big contracts that are going to women, minority, and emerging small business companies. And I think we relayed to them that we were interested in finding out not only about construction contracts, but also goods and services as well, and to see what we can do to spur economic development and contracting with our own companies here in Oregon, what, if anything, we can do along those lines. And so at this point, I think, should we jump in? Patrick, you want to jump into the testimony, or should we do the committee measures first? Or
give sure, it would only take about 1 minute to do the committee measures if you'd like to do that and get those out of the way.
Okay.
So just open a work session, there we go.
Okay. Open a work session on that. Okay. I'd like to open a work session on the introduction of committee measures.
Mr. Chair, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 1318, LC 1319, LC 1431, LC 2144, LC 2785, LC 2858, LC 3780. I just know I didn't add some of my own in there.
So you got plenty of time. The chair would be happy to entertain it. Senator George has moved the aforementioned list of LCs be introduced as committee bills, and of course, colleagues, this does not indicate that you support or oppose these. These are only for introduction, and the actual vote on the merits or demerits of these bills will come at a different time. Is there any discussion?
Oh, yeah. Demerits of the bills, you mean? Oh, I'm okay, Mr. Chair.
Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chairman, one more.
Yeah, Patrick.
I spoke with Dana Richardson by email today and over the phone last week, and just for clarification purposes, the deadline for committees to drop LC drafts at the Senate desk is Thursday the 17th, with a couple exceptions, the exceptions being the only committee bills that can be introduced after the 17th are what are called the 2 and 2 committee priority bills. The committees are allowed under Senate Rule 1315 to introduce two at the request of the chair and two at the request of the vice chair with the chair's approval. So if members have LC drafts that they'd like to have introduced as committee bills, besides those two plus two, they would have to be probably introduced by next Wednesday.
Okay.
At the latest.
Good. And colleagues, I'm very open to introducing committee bills for you if that's your preference as well. Okay. We closed the work session, right? So we can just jump right in. So we will jump into the informational meeting, and the first presenter is from the Department of Administrative Services, Diane Lancaster, Chief Procurement Officer. Ms. Lancaster, take it away.
Thank you, Senator Shields, Vice Senator George, and committee members. I am Diane Lancaster. I'm the Chief Procurement Officer at the DAS Department of Administrative Services. Our office has some general oversight around contracting opportunities, and I'll share some information with you this afternoon I hope will be helpful. The first point I think we need to be aware of is that Oregon, as far as the procurement landscape is concerned, has a very decentralized situation. Many agencies have a lot of independent of statutory authority, including the university system, state lottery, Secretary of State, Oregon Health Sciences University, legislative branch, judicial branch, etc. And many agencies have a number of statutory carve-outs of authority, ODOT, Department of Human Resources, Department of Education, Parks, and others. And of course, the local governments have independent authority. So the role of my office, in large part, is to be a place for agencies, local governments, and suppliers to meet to buy and sell products and services that Oregonians and Oregon state agencies use and local governments may use. Our primary tool for this is the Oregon Procurement Information Network. This is the electronic procurement system, and it has been running for many years, and hundreds of agencies use it. I think it's important to recognize that this database, this system, contains registrations of all types of bidders and suppliers for construction, goods and services of every type and kind. You'll notice the history of supplier registration. We cut over from a very old legacy system in December of 2005, and we started with about 10,000 known vendors. Today, as of December, we have over 48,000 suppliers who are listed in ORPIN. Over half of them are Oregon-registered businesses, we're proud to say, and all 3,186 minority women and emerging small businesses are registered as well. We enjoy a nightly data file transfer from the certifying office for minority women and emerging small business, so we know that we capture every single business that gains certification. The businesses in ORPIN, which are certified, are further identified by gold stars next to them, so that agencies who are looking to, say, put out some quotes or formal requests for bids can easily identify those firms that they would like to include. The system itself, we believe, is quite user-friendly, even though it has now reached capacity, and you may hear about this in other hearings during this session, because ORPIN is actually sort of a victim of its own success. We had no idea when we opened it up that there would be such a dramatic use of it. But today, there are 29 government agencies, including a number of local governments, who post solicitation opportunities on it at the average of about 140 a day. We have taken the liberty of setting up a dummy access code so that you or your staff might take a spin around ORPIN, and you'd be most welcome to do that. This is in your handout, and if you or a staff member would like to tap into ORPIN, we have provided a password and a passcode for you. Now, to the heart of the matter, we are committed and deeply interested in how Oregon business is faring in the marketplace. And these statistics are for the past 2 years. For fiscal year 2009 and 2010, we start with the notion of Oregon businesses and how are they doing. We note that both years, about 75% of the total contracts listed in ORPIN were awarded to Oregon businesses. We also note that the dollar values of those contracts are very similar to the percentage of awards, and that's an important figure because you would not want to see that skewed. You want to see them getting a hefty size of the contract dollars. And in the last two fiscal years, you'll see the dollars at $2.25 billion for fiscal year 09 and $1.71 billion for fiscal year 2010.
Mr. Chair, question on that?
Yes.
Senator Boquist. Your previous slide. You indicated, thank you, Mr. Chair. You indicated, Madam, that this is awarded to Oregon businesses. Is this the entire state, inclusive of the independent agencies that are operating in the carve-outs, or is this just what is tracked and monitored through your system in your office?
Senator Shields, Vice Senator George, Senator Boquist, your assumption is correct. This is not the complete picture by any means. This is simply the collection of those pieces of information which agencies subject to some of our authority or all of our authority have keyed in. Okay. So it does not include many of the entities that we spoke of earlier.
Follow-up question, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
Just in broad sweeping terms, I mean, 20% goes through your office, 30%, 40%, or?
Senator Boquist, I would be speculating at best. To think of how much of the total state business might be going through ORPIN. I really don't have a good answer for that, and I'm not sure how to get at that information.
Thank you, Madam.
Thank you, sir.
Which is the root of the problem.
But we could get to that, presumably, by taking the $2.25 billion and adding up the total procurement dollars of all the carve-outs and the independents, right?
Senator Shields, certainly you could do some manipulations with figures and that might be provided by other entities. And I know some of my colleagues from other major state agencies are going to be up and presenting information. So we may get to some enlightenment throughout this presentation series.
Yeah, and my sense, Senator Boquist, was that we would gather probably 70 to 80% of all state dollars just by having the biggest agencies present. But it's a good question.
Mm-hmm. It's an excellent question. Thank you. We do know that out of that database, that for a similar two-year period, a total of 229 contracts valued at $58 million were awarded to certified minority women and emerging small business firms. And again, that is the ORPIN statistics.
And so I'm a little rusty, since I'm not on Ways and Means anymore, can you help me understand what percentage of the total dollars that would be?
I would have to calculate in my head at this moment, Senator Shields, but it looks to me, let me not calculate it in my head. Let me provide that answer immediately after the hearing.
58 million of 1.71.
Did you want me to go back to the previous slide?
No, we'll figure it out before you leave the table.
Thank you. Now, we're very pleased at my office, in addition to housing the Oregon Procurement Information Network, my office actually is responsible for putting together statewide price agreements. These price agreements are for goods and services of all types, and they are available to all state agencies and to participating local governments and nonprofit entities, which I'll tell you a little bit more about later in this slide program. This particular project is one that my office is doing, and we have been exploring in the last several years how we can take these statewide agreements and either break them up or ask the major companies who get these awards and require them to reach out and include minority women and emerging small businesses as sub-providers. Not just subcontractors as in the construction business, but providers of goods and services as well. In this case, what we're showing here is what we call an information technology managed service provider project. This project is now several years old and has come to, I think, pretty much full scope. But what you'll notice, because it is the actual contractor is a prime, the minority women and emerging small businesses that are represented here are actually subcontractors in this case. And so this data traditionally has not been counted in the totup of actual direct awards. But this is a very successful project, and I think it's notable. What we see here, and this is over a 2.5-year period, is that out of a total of 647 work orders, 25% of those went to certified firms. That's a very remarkable contribution. On the dollar side, 24% of the dollars went with those awards to the collection of minority women and emerging small business firms. And you can see the dollars that are counted, the total spend of almost $60 million, and $14.5 million of that going to the certified firms. Now, the reason I think this is a notable project is because this is a situation where this is very rare for us to have a prime contractor for something other than construction. And in this case, what we found was that the prime, who has a staffed office in Wilsonville that serves all of these smaller businesses who are technically subcontractors, that company provides them such assistance by a software system, helps them with filling out bid forms and that type of thing. I believe that the extra hands-on service that is provided probably accounts for why there is such a high degree of success for these firms in this particular arena. These projects are for staff augmentation services like database administrators. They are also for projects, actual software installations or software development projects. I thought you would also want to know, from our perspective, what government is spending its money on. This is a 12-month sample and you'll see that 62%, well over half of the purchases are for information technology-related goods and services. Another 14% are for telecommunications. And telecommunications goods and services are now heavily involved with technology because of the, you know, basically all telecommunications are now technologically driven. So really about three-fourths of the purchases represented in this sample, which totes up to, I think it's about $100 million, you can see are technology driven. Then the green slice represents fleet-related. And you have a brochure that we've provided to you that includes some work that we are doing with tires. One of the things we have done with tire contracts is to open them up and to try to encourage the smaller local tire dealers to participate. And so any tire dealer that carries certain brands, we have made it possible for them to participate, and that brochure is at your side with your handout. Also then, of course, we have the office environment piece, and we have, that's the yellow, and then the slice that is facilities management. Those are tools and supplies that facilities use. So as I've said, many of these price agreements, we are now offering opportunities for minority women and emerging small businesses to participate in these contracts, and we have in our office supply and janitorial supply arenas 6 firms. These are major firms, and each of these firms has made a commitment to include sub-providers in the minority women and emerging small business arena, and we require that in the contracts. We required it in the solicitation process, and we require periodic reports from these firms about how they are making use of these minority women and emerging small business firms. And we're also very pleased with the new ability to prefer Oregon produce. We are just this week awarding new grocery contracts that will be used by corrections institutions, Oregon State Hospital, and others to purchase locally produced farm agricultural products and food. And we mark that mainly for the note that there are a lot of small businesses, small farms that may benefit from that. Now, it is important to note the local government participation. As I commented, the local governments are able to participate in our contracts by virtue of a program called the Oregon Cooperative Purchasing Program. And this particular sample for a 12-month period, ending March of 2009, you'll see that the local governments, there are 500 of them at the time, that says ORCAP, that's the Oregon Cooperative Purchasing Group, they purchased nearly half of the goods and services off the top 30 supply contracts, and that profile of those contracts was in that previous slide, you know, IT, telecommunications, office, fleet, and facilities management. That's who is buying those. And I mention this because local government is a huge consumer of goods and services. Here's a profile then of the local government types who participate in our program. It includes universities, school districts, tribal, nonprofit, public benefit corporations, qualified rehabilitation facilities, and the like. And we noted that today we had 20 local government solicitation projects that are published on ORPIN. We have a variety of local procurement opportunities in playground equipment, local food, tires, as we've mentioned, lawn and garden equipment. We then finally took the liberty of including a listing of entities in each of your areas that is participating in the Oregon Cooperative Procurement Program, and this is at the end of your handout. With that, we have a few notices at the end of the presentation about upcoming events. And our office does provide webinars and a variety of training services on how to do business with state government. We are participating in the Governor's Marketplace on February 24th, and the Governor's Advocate, Cheryl Myers, for minority women and emerging small businesses in the audience today. And there will be a trade show in Salem on March 15th where any firm can come and talk with buyers from all over state and local government. With that, thank you for your time. And if you have any questions for me, I'd be glad to try to answer them.
Questions, Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It appears over the last couple of years we've actually dropped in the percentage of Oregon-based companies. You know, is that in terms of, because I'm looking at a three-year-old memo that's from you, by the way, it indicates, you know, that much smaller size back then, but as a percentage, there's less, just small, 5% less Oregon businesses, you know, buying or, you know, involved in the Oregon process. Is that probably realized because you now have gone from three or four thousand small amount of bidders to this huge pool? Is that probably what that reflection is, or is it because there's more Oregon businesses struggling and can't participate, or?
Senator Shields, Senator George, Senator Boquist, I think either one of those could be so. I think the rapid growth of the Orpin base of vendors is probably, that there are simply so many vendors who are applying that percentage has dropped slightly. There should be no barrier to any Oregon business in participating in Orpin. It's free. You self-register. So in order to participate or to look at Orpin for opportunities, there should be no hindrance. So it might be the other reason.
Paul, Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you. Our present preference law, which, of course, you have to comply with, and some of the other agencies don't have to comply with at this point in time, only covers, you know, a limited amount of areas. Can you talk a little bit about Oregon's existing goods and services preference law? And I realize that we have reciprocal agreements with, I think, at least half the states in the union. So can you talk about Oregon preference or buy Oregon versus other states and where we fit into the entire state process from your perspective as the chief procurement officer?
Senator Shields, Senator George, Senator Boquist. Senator Boquist, you are absolutely correct. We live in a world of reciprocity. We are surrounded by, and I believe there are over 30 states in the union now, if not more, who established these reciprocal preference statutes. And what that means, of course, is that if you disadvantage my state's businesses in your state, then I will disadvantage your businesses at the bidding table. Oregon is actually surrounded. Washington, Idaho, California, most of the western states have these statutes. Mm-hmm. And so that's been in place for many years. And so other than the reciprocity, which really makes it open borders, so that an Oregon bidder is not disadvantaged in Washington or Idaho, and certainly those bidders are not disadvantaged here because of the reciprocity statutes. So that's the way the goods and services world is set up, and as you say, very common across the country, and of course encourages interstate commerce and that type of thing. There are a few other preferences in Oregon state government. One of them is for printing. And the state does have a printing preference. It's not actually in the public procurement code. I believe it's in the state printing code. And so all printing, and including, interestingly, license plates, are actually, which are considered printing under the statute, actually has a preference here. There is a tiebreaker preference, so that if two bidders come to the table and their bids are the same, the Oregon firm is preferred. Other than that, and certainly now with many emerging recyclable content, or, you know, those aren't really preferences, but there are a number of statutes that require us to buy goods and services that focus on sustainability. And how that plays into the equation, I'm not totally sure, but certainly businesses in Oregon who work in that arena then gain some advantage.
Ms. Lancaster, I don't know if something got lost in translation, but what I was interested in getting from each agency is a list of their top 10 contracts, who they're contracted to, the amounts, and whether or not they're Oregon companies, whether or not they're MWESBs. Do you have that information?
Senator Shields, I don't have that with me, but we'll provide it later today. We, because of the top 30 price agreements, we'll be able to give that to you easily.
Okay. Yeah, good. And another question, can you talk about the ways that the state can contract out outside of the competitive bid process? Are there ways that that can be done?
Senator Shields, there are a variety of ways that the state can use methods to contract out. One of them, as we've talked about, for example, in the office supplies, we did not do an invitation to bid, which is price only. We did a request for proposals. And when you do a request for proposals, you set up different scoring criteria. And you can award points to the proposers on the basis of various factors. So in that case, we actually set up criteria to benefit proposers who brought a plan on how they would include minority women and emerging small businesses as sub-providers if they were given the contract. So that's one very good way to get at some of the values that we are talking about today. And I'm not sure if there's any other really direct way to do it, but we found that that seems to be quite effective, and we've now used it with janitorial supplies and, you know, some other areas that we're working on, like the tires.
Okay. Senator Boquist.
You opened the can of worms, Mr. Chair. So, a follow-up question along what the Chair is saying here. Is there not another mechanism if you do the lowest, technically, you put a technical weight to a proposal versus the price weight to it? Because I believe under Oregon law, as long as, it doesn't exceed 3.5, there's two thresholds, 3.5% and 5%, where you could have a contract out there in which they're actually providing a better service or a better benefit to the state versus another, and an Oregon bidder might be 3% higher and get the award of the contract worth an out-of-state or beat out an out-of-state because of that. Is that not correct?
Senator Shields, Senator George, Senator Boquist, I'm not totally sure all the variations that you could think of to put into a request for proposal process. The process itself is designed, or the goal is to achieve best value rather than lowest dollar price, as you do in an ordinary competitive bid. So when you create the criteria and align the points that will be awarded to determine who's going to get the proposal, who's going to get the award, that's when you start to consider the value of price. And if I'm following what you're asking clearly, that pricing component generally is going to be worth only some percentage of the total, because we're talking about a best value kind of solicitation method. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you might choose to award a contract based on a pricing value of maybe 30%. And there were other factors that you would look at, and they might be technology, expertise, references, warranties, and certainly the potential for inclusion of small business and minority women in emerging small business, which is what we've done in some of these examples. Does that answer your question, sir?
Thank you.
Good. So if you could get the top 10 list to us, as well as also in the MWESB information, if you could break down that, what was it, $58 million into how many of those were ESBs, women-owned businesses, and any data you might have on the particular ethnicities of those people?
Certainly. We'll do our best to provide that, Senator.
Good. I appreciate that. And I'd heard that DAS offers the potential of contracting without a competitive bid process on consulting contracts if the contractor has already been certified by GSA. Can you tell me any information about that?
Certainly, Senator Shields. We participate in the federal GSA cooperative. Governments all over are doing cooperative work, and GSA has a state-local cooperative program. Through that program, the federal government has opened up certain what they call contract schedules. And these schedules are collections of various types of contracts. They have focused on to date, and it takes an act of the federal Congress to approve the opening of these schedules. But to date, they have opened up what they call Schedule 70, which is for information technology. They have opened up some other schedules. for a variety of public safety requirements. State agencies who are subject to our authority are permitted to use these contracts that are open to them, and they and we have, by administrative rule, created a process that they can do that. They do not need to do an open competitive solicitation. They need to simply do some, do some work to figure out if it's the best value for them. They need to post a notice on ORPIM that they intend to do this, and then they go ahead and they do the contract.
And then they just pulled from the GSA list.
Yes.
Could you also get some information for me on what percentage of those who go through that process are minority women in emerging small businesses?
Senator Shields, I'll be honest with you. I'm not sure that I'll be able to obtain that, but we'll certainly take a look
do
at that.
Do what you can. Great. And also I've been hearing some talk about the transformation project at DAS. If you could get me the amount of dollars spent in that area and who the contractors are for that project, I would be grateful too.
Senator Shields, I'll be glad to do that. The department itself has those contracts, and I'll certainly check in with the contracting officer and ask them to provide that for you.
Great. Thank you.
Right.
Any other questions?
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
All right. Next up we have from ODOT, Clyde, can you help me with the last name?
Saki.
The Deputy Director, Central Services Division with the Oregon Department of Transportation. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Chair Shields.
We have a handout that's going to be coming around, so I'll just give staff a minute to...
And Mr. Carroll, could you also identify yourself, too?
I'll introduce him as we
okay.
get started. In fact, Chair Shields, Vice Chair George, and members of the committee, for the record, Clyde Saki, Deputy for Central Services for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And with me at the table is Michael Cobb, who is the manager of our Office of Civil Rights. So the packet you have coming around contains three items. Our written testimony, we also provided the list of top 10 contracts in four different areas. The list also identifies which of these entities are Oregon-based and also which entities are minority women or emerging small business entities. And then a handout that I'm going to use for my presentation today. So starting on page 2 of the handout, we have the four principles that drive ODOT's procurement process, and it's this this handout right here with us. The four principles are to ensure transparent and competitive bidding process, competitive bidding process, to ensure compliance with all state and federal laws and rules, to ensure unrestricted competition, and also to have systems in place to detect and prevent collusion. Page 3 talks a little bit about our two major areas of contracting. We have contracts, typically construction contracts associated with the statewide transportation improvement program, which is our 4-year transportation capital improvement program, and also supporting services such as engineering, information technology, and other goods and services. On page 4, we have a breakdown of the volume of those contracts. Our highway construction contracts account for about 80% of our public contracting. It equates to approximately $460 million a year, $920 million over the course of a biennium, which funds approximately 91 projects a year. In the second category, which includes goods, trades, and services contracts, we have approximately $117 million a year, $234 million over the course of a biennium, with an annual volume, transaction volume of about 1,500 contracts a year, or 3,000 over the course of a biennium. Oops. On page 5, we provided information about the number of our contracts that go to Oregon-based firms. Approximately 85% of the dollars that we contract out for go to Oregon-based firms. We did not calculate the dollar value of that. We can certainly do that and get that back to you, but you get some idea of the amount of money that goes to Oregon-based firms if you look at the list of the top 10 contractors that was also provided in the packet. And just to be clear, the way we identified Oregon-based contractors were companies that had business addresses in Oregon, so they include local companies like Wildish Standard Paving and also national companies that have permanent Oregon business addresses, such as CH2M Hill. ODOT is committed to increasing the competitiveness of minority and women and emerging small business contractors. We see it as a good business investment, and it helps us secure the qualified and diverse workforce that we need. On page 7, we took a look at 4 years' worth of data, 2006 through 2009, and in that time period, minority women and emerging small businesses received approximately 13% of the contract dollars associated with our construction contracts, which averaged out to be about $60 million of the department's $460 million in highway construction contracts.
That's an average per year?
Over 4 years. Million. Yeah, four-year average per year, annual average, figure. Okay. Right. Sure, Shields. On page 8, we talk about improving opportunities for minority women and emerging small businesses. And an important component of that is really outreach and training. And under the first bullet, there are three sub-bullets which talk about three initiatives, three of many, actually, that the department is involved in to increase opportunities. The first, the Small Business Development Center. Through that program, we provide businesses with management training, such as bookkeeping and marketing. The Turner School of Construction Management, which teaches hands-on construction skills. And then we work with the Oregon Association of Minority Entrepreneurs to connect minority and small businesses with ODOT's experts and leaders so we can provide coaching, mentoring, technical assistance, and support. And where possible, we do use alternative contracting methods to allow a more diverse contractor pool and give them opportunities to bid on the work that we contract out. Our Office of Civil Rights works with minority women and emerging small businesses to identify barriers that keep them from bidding on our contractors, and as demonstrated by the previous page, their mission is to provide programs and technical assistance and support to remove those barriers so that those entities can be competitive as they bid for the department's contracts. And with that, I'll stop and see if the committee has any questions.
Question, Senator Boquist.
Thank you. I just want to go back and clarify. You made a statement of, you know, what is ODOT's definition of an Oregon-based business?
Chair Shields, Vice Chair George, and Senator Boquist, on page, so I've got a little out of order here. What page is that? On page of 5 of the handout, the second bullet, we define an Oregon business as a company with an Oregon business address, which includes local companies like Wildish that's in that example. And then we also include national companies that have permanent offices in Oregon, like CH2M Hill, which has an office in Corvallis.
Sure. Just for the record, you have to have a permanent office in the state of Oregon to do business under the Secretary of State laws. There's a lot of businesses that don't operate illegally, but because I looked through the list here, and some of these I know for a fact are foreign-owned corporations. So that might be something the committee might want to look at in the future, you know, how do we define Oregon businesses? Because anybody who does business in the state of Oregon must have an Oregon address, street address, and office to legally operate. So thank you.
That's a good question. Follow-up to that, Hamilton Construction is an international, part of an international corporation. Is that right?
Chair Shields, I'm not sure what their status is. As we pulled the list, we just used the criteria that I explained to the committee earlier. So we could certainly get that do some further investigation and get that back to you.
Okay. And I just really appreciate that this was very responsive.
Sure.
It was exactly what we asked for, listing out the individual companies and the contracts. I think what you didn't see as part of the presentation, for those of you who are out there, is that of the 10 largest construction contracts, not one went to a minority women or emerging small business. In the top 10 personal services contracts that are also in the millions of dollars, not one went to a minority women or emerging small business. And then in the top 10 trade services contracts, three were emerging small businesses. Two of those three were women-owned. Am I reading that correctly?
That's correct, Chair Shields.
Yeah. You know, I think just getting the facts out there allow us to deal with them and figure out how we can improve upon those numbers if we want to. That is
most definitely.
Any other questions right now, Senator Monroe?
Well, they're showing 13% of dollars, contract dollars spent with women's and small business firms, 13%, and yet none of them got in the top 10. That seems a little out of skew. The reason I ask is 2 years ago I was on the Transportation Subcommittee of Ways and Means, and we had ODOT in there, and they were talking about how they had, I think it was 13%, minority women-owned contracts. And then we asked them about the dollars, and then they ended up at less than 1%. In other words, the women and minority-owned contracts that were led were the very small contracts. And seeing these lists of the top 10 here makes me wonder if that's really changed much.
Please respond.
Chair Shields, Vice Chair George, Senator Monroe. When you look at the top 10 lists, I think one of the things that doesn't reflect are the subcontractors that these entities will subcontract out with. It just shows who the general contractor is. An example is a project we have now renovating the transportation building. Hoffman Construction will show as the general contractor, but to date, 18% of the work and the dollars that are going to Hoffman are being subcontracted out to minority women or emerging small business contractors.
Paul,
Senator Boquist. Thank
you, sure. And it wasn't part of the presentation, but we're trying to address economic development here. And I guess my question is, your slide page 7 slide, you know, shows out the average $460 million highway construction contracts in a year. What's the backlog at ODOT right now in terms of what's available in funding you have for contracts that are yet to be let? I know there's a big process to go through in which, you know, we'll create more jobs in the future.
Chair Shields, Senator George, Vice Chair George, Senator Boquist, I don't have a number I can give you at this point in time, but it's certainly a number I can get to you and the members of the committee.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chair. It'd be interesting to know because we're trying to forecast job growth and,
right,
and get going here.
We can supply you with that information.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Cobb, did you have anything that you wanted to present?
No, Senator.
Okay. Well, why don't you identify yourself just for the good people who are watching on television?
Yes, Senator Shields. Michael Cobb, Manager, Office of Civil Rights, Oregon Department of Transportation.
Senator George.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. I'm trying to kind of go through and figure out exactly the ownership of these companies. And some of them are either employee-owned or publicly owned. And so it's kind of skewing it a little bit as far as, because obviously if it's employee-owned, it's not designated. So how do you come up with the designation of emerging small business or a minority-owned business if it's publicly owned or if it's a... how is that? Because it seems like it skews the numbers for us. It's hard for us to see what's going on because a publicly owned company or a employee-owned company can't be put in the same category as a closely held company.
Sure. Senator Shields and Senator George, the answer to that is it's all through the certification process, which is handled through the Office of OMWESB. There are certain criteria for being an ESB firm, and I mean I don't have the exact answer as to whether and why a company is publicly or privately owned, but in order for that firm to become an ESB, he has to meet strict criteria, you know, and that's done starting with the Secretary of State, going through that process and then through the certification process. So by the time that we get them, they're designated as an ESB firm, and we get a nightly download of those firms that are designated ESB, DVE, MW, and so on down the line. But we, if I needed to go in to check and verify what the ownership of the firm is, I could do that, but we, you know.
Follow up. So one of the things that kind of throws us off here is you see these huge numbers, you know, $60 million sent to this mm-hmm. company. If it's a publicly owned firm, it kind of skews our view as far as how things are being awarded or what the opportunities are, because publicly traded companies are a little different than closely held companies. And I think one of the tough things for us to know is that how this is being applied, because obviously publicly owned companies or employee-owned companies could have a huge number of minority-owned, women-owned shares in it. So, I mean, that's... So it's a little tough, I think, for us to kind of process kind of mixing everything into one pot and then trying to draw conclusions from that. Because I can't draw a conclusion from this kind of information because it's clearly skewed based on the ownership. So if there's any way to make that more clear to us, it'd be helpful, I think.
Chair Shields and Vice Chair George, I think we can do a further breakdown of that information to get to the issue you're raising and then provide that to the committee.
Okay. Thank you.
Maybe the SEC keeps records. So
yeah, well, I mean, I just kind
of emerging
small. Going through this, really
emerging tough. Small shareholders. No, your point's well taken, though. Okay, before we go, could Mr. Cobb, could you give us, a very quick Reader's Digest version of the disparity study in the past, any efforts and successes you've had since the disparity study, and I think you're considering a second one or perhaps might even have one in the works right now. Could you just give us disparity study 101, please?
Yes, Senator Shields and Senator George. In a nutshell, the first disparity study that we did was prompted by the Ninth Circuit Court decision that said that any state agency that had hard goals would have to cease having hard goals in projects. That is, identifying specific ethnic groups as being able to have goals towards their preference, if you will. That had to cease unless you had compelling evidence that there was indeed disparity. So the first disparity study, which ended in 2007, the conclusion drawn there was that African American and Asian firms were those firms that had disparate utilization. Following that, in order for us to actually institute hard goals again, we had to get approval from the U.S. Department of Transportation, and it's called a waiver, where we had to show the disparity study and its findings and give all of the evidence, all of the documentation. They granted that waiver that said we could now set goals on contracts with African and African American and Asian firms in our contracts, okay? The other ethnicities were not addressed. 3 years progressed under that waiver, and the time was coming now that waiver was about to expire. The waiver is only good for 3 years. So again, according to the Code of Federal Regulations, in order for you to continue having such a waiver, you have to show that the disparity still exists. So therefore, we implemented in November, we launched our second disparity study, which is an update to the first one, to give us an idea just how did we fare under the utilization of having hard goals on our contracts in the first one. So that is underway right now. It's being progressed with a completion date for June of this year. Reader's Digest.
Thank you. That was very helpful. And can you tell me about any advances that happened because of the disparity study?
We've seen numbers. We have seen numbers improve. We are not where we would like to be yet. African-American numbers have improved some. We have not really seen an adverse impact in those ethnic groups that were not called out in the, we haven't seen a decrease, in other words, in those groups that were not called out. There has been some slight improvement. Still not where we want to be.
And could you get, I'm sure you have those numbers in the
Absolutely.
Civil Rights Office. Could you get that to us? We might review them at the next meeting. And also, I think there were, seven or eight different recommendations
Yes.
In the disparity study. Could everything from, joint ventures to bidder rotation to using contracting, kind of innovative contracting processes similar to what they have at TriMet. Could you report on which of those you decided to implement? And which ones you didn't, you decided to take a pass on. And I do want to commend ODOT. I remember early on in my legislative career, I went to a construction association meeting down at the convention center, and nobody knew who I was, and I just went up and had a beer, started talking to somebody, and I said, what type of construction do you do? And he said, well, I do it mostly for an unnamed state agency. It wasn't ODOT. And I said, so do you have to do a lot of the the civil rights work at ODOT? Oh, no, they don't make us do any of that stuff. So I say that not to disparage other state agencies, but that we put you in the spotlight a lot. But I think that we do construction projects all over the state in a whole variety of agencies, mm-hmm. and right. We should hold everybody to a high standard.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Next up is the Oregon Department of Human Services and the Office of Contracts and Procurement. Stella Transu. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Senator Shields and Senator George and members of the committee. I'm Stella Transu, the Administrator for the Office of Contracts and Procurement for the Shared Services of Department of Human Services and Oregon Health Authority. Thanks for the opportunity to share some information about our contracting process. So you have my testimony in front of you, and I will go through it now, and if you have questions, just let me know. We promote contracting with Oregon-owned, women- and minority-owned, and emerging small businesses through a variety of methods. Contracts and Procurement maintains a presence at the Governor's Marketplace trade show for many years, and in the past at the Hispanic Metropolitan Trade Show in Portland. The trade shows provide an opportunity to let others know about contracting opportunities within the Department of Human Services and Oregon Health Authority, and afford the ability to provide contact information for our program staff. We have enjoyed the presence of the Governor's Advocate at our all-staff meetings to discuss how we can work cooperatively to promote Oregon-owned, women- and minority-owned, and emerging small businesses. I had the opportunity to meet Cheryl this afternoon and look forward to working with her and having her come into our one of our all-staff meetings and continue that relationship. DHS and OHA advertise all required procurement opportunities on the ORPIN system, and you heard about that earlier from Diane. This alerts the minority women emerging small business registered suppliers of solicitations and makes available a central location for them to respond to applicable solicitations. Contracts and Procurement also provides a link to the OMWEB's website on our webpage, and we discuss the importance of these vendors during our procurement trainings for our program staff. I just want to mention one item when there was a question about are all of the items from large state agencies that have carve-outs, are they on the ORPIN system? And Department of Human Services puts all of their awards on the ORPIN system. So any carve-out or anything, we post all of our contract awards, even if they weren't a result of a solicitation or an RFP. DHS uses a non-traditional short-form contract for some of our child welfare services out in our local branches. Because these services are client-related and below the required posting threshold, ORPIN is not utilized. Instead, there is a direct negotiation with potential contractors. These contractors are usually small providers doing business with the state, generally for the first time, and they're often not registered, but they may meet the requirements of the OMWEB's registration. And if they do think that's something that they would like, our staff can provide them the information for the Advocate's Office to do that certification. Now, I just want to mention our Oregon State Hospital Replacement Project. They have, the general contractor for that is Hoffman, and they have worked really hard to promote and reach out to Oregon-owned women and minority-owned emerging small businesses. They hired two outreach consultants, and Hoffman Construction Procurement Group themselves had these outreach events to inform small contractors of potential projects, describe the projects and the importance to their community, and to meet the general contractor and learn how they do business. The prime subcontractors were also encouraged to include Oregon minority emerging small business contractors. As a result of the outreach, over 80% of the contracted work for the Oregon State Hospital Replacement Project went to Oregon contractors. Overall, there were 14% of the combined value was awarded to minority-owned women and emerging small business contractors. And we have our top 10. I didn't include on there if they're Oregon-owned, but...
Is Multnomah County foreign-owned or domestically owned?
Foreign-owned.
I guess you could debate that. Electronic Data System is now, that was our MMIS, and that's now owned by HP, so that is a California-owned company. But everything else is Oregon, either governmental or owned company. None of these are emerging small businesses or minority women-owned that we know of.
Okay.
We don't have the best data system. It's for pulling information about Oregon-owned businesses, so we don't have lots of information on that, but just anecdotally, I would say over 80% of our business is with Oregon-owned companies. Some of the larger ITs probably aren't.
And we've heard a lot about EDS in Ways and Means over the years. Is there any questions from the committee? Can you tell me a little bit about the nature of Rose Haven Nursing Center and that contract?
That's a nursing home. And these, and again, because of the way we have to pull information, these are actually a five-year, not to exceed.
Okay.
We can't, because of our system, it's hard to, we can't just pull for 1 year.
Okay.
So it is a nursing home.
Okay. Yeah, that seemed rather significant.
And the counties, all of these counties here, those are for what we refer to as our county financial assistance agreements, so they're for addictions, mental health, developmental disabilities, those types of services.
Mm-hmm. And as far as, you said there's an exception for some foster care providers. Are we talking primarily about individual kind of family homes where they have room for five kids, or are we talking about a large outfit like Boys and Girls Aid Society or Maple Star that you contract out for a significant amount of services?
The non-traditional that I was talking about?
Yeah, you said in paragraph 3, non-traditional, yes.
So those would be smaller, like the Boys and Girls Aid, no, Maple Star, no. We're referring to, these are out in the communities when a child may need tutoring,
okay.
Things like that. So specific services generally for a specific child.
Under $100,000, certainly.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Usually under $5,000.
All right. Good. Any questions from the committee? Thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate it. All right. Next up, the Oregon Department of Corrections, Tammy Dorman, Assistant Director for General Services. Welcome to the committee.
Hi.
If you could identify yourself and please give your testimony.
Senator Shields and members of the committee, my name is Tammy Dorman. I'm the Assistant Director for General Services at the Department of Corrections. And you've heard a lot from the other agencies. We contract very similar to the other agencies. But we, our department houses approximately 14,000 inmates in 14 prisons across the state, and we have responsibility for their daily needs, clothing, food, health care, and keeping up our buildings. So our major payments are going to be around those daily type activities. And I have attached on the second page, these are the top 20 vendor payments that we've made in this, from the beginning of this biennium to date. And I actually went to 20 so you could kind of get a little bigger picture than 10. And we have put the states on the states where the companies are from. So we put all our solicitations over $5,000 on ORPIN so that any minority women or emerging small businesses can bid on them. The ORPIN system doesn't integrate directly with our payment system, so it's very difficult for us to pull out, did those companies that we paid actually, were they emerging small or minority and women businesses?
Is that it?
Yeah.
Okay. Getting us back on schedule.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Concessions appreciated. So, looking at these, as far as the list of these, mm-hmm. as far as you know, none of them are minority
businesses. I don't know. Now, some of these providers are, you know, community colleges that provide like education services mm-hmm. to our inmates, and so I'm sure that they have affirmative action policies and they employ minorities and women just like the state does. So, but I have no way of knowing okay. if they're on the list.
But as far as the private entities, none of them are registered with the NWESP.
Because our payment system doesn't communicate with the other system, I'd have to go back and really, you know, it's like checking manually for all of those things.
Okay. All right.
So I don't know that answer.
Okay. Well, I mean, if you took out the nonprofits, you're looking at probably six or seven.
Mm-hmm.
The NWESP office is in Boley now, is that correct? Or is it still in DCBS?
Business
Oregon, that's right. Okay. If you could just get for the next meeting, just find
yeah,
out if any of them are registered,
okay.
that's all.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right. Next up is Bob Simonton, Assistant Vice Chancellor, Capital Programs, Oregon University System.
Good afternoon, Chair Shields and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bob Simonton. I'm with the Oregon University System. So today I'd like to start by providing some context within our MWESB efforts, and I have a handout that I've provided to you. So if you go to page 2, it shows a graph of how our construction priorities have changed or shifted over the last decade or so. As a building owner, we typically look to measure our success in three factors. They're kind of interrelated. I call it good, fast, cheap. So we want our projects to be good quality, we want them done on time, and want them to be within budget. But those priorities have shifted recently. We're now looking at what's called the triple bottom line, where the budget is still a large component of that interaction, but we're also looking at environmental aspects of the projects and also social equity. So as far as the environment piece, each of our projects, we use a benchmark that are required to be LEED Silver or better. Now, the social equity component, it's a little more difficult to benchmark due to the what was mentioned earlier, the Ninth Circuit Court ruling in 2005 that no longer allows state agencies to set goals, targets, or preferences based on race or gender. So the State Board of Higher Education has recognized this shift in priorities and has directed us to revise our MWESB policy using more of a continuous improvement type of strategy rather than the targets or goals that we'd previously used. So some of the steps we have taken in recent years, we're trying to rekindle our relationships with the MWSB community, and also in the next several pages are some of the community outreach efforts that we've done over the past year. Those efforts include attending several governor's marketplaces, vendor trade shows, MWSB conferences, participation in the Oregon Association of Minority Entrepreneurs. We've also attended the National Conference of the National Association of Minority Contractors and also the Hispanic Chambers. And what we're trying to do at these events is share our contracting opportunities with folks that attend these conferences and also get feedback from them to learn how we can do a better job of contracting with the minority and women emerging small business communities. Some of the things we've learned is that we need to go out and discover the best practices that are currently taking place in Oregon. And to do that, we've met with folks from Multnomah County, TriMet, City of Portland, and the Portland Development Commission, kind of learn how they're so successful and how we can adapt and adopt some of their procedures and policies and see how they can we can relate that to a state agency. We've also held a contractor forum where we've met the campuses, construction folks have met with larger contractors to figure out how we can do a better job of reaching the MWSB community. And some of the things we've learned is that if we break up our larger bid packages into smaller pieces, we provide more opportunities. We've also learned that if we include in our selection criteria elements of, you know, we've always looked at price, quality, and back to my little good, fast, cheap wheel. But if we also have in the selection criteria base it on contractor outreach to the MWSB community and have the contractor set the participation goals, we can do a better job of increasing our numbers. We've also realized that we can't manage what we don't measure. So we've realized that some of our software was not up to date and we have a very difficult time of tracking how successful or unsuccessful we are. Fortunately, many of the MWESB community folks are not bashful and they tell us if we're not doing a good job, but it's nice to have the data. So we've implemented new software in our retainer program. We're also implementing new facilities and project management software, so it will be much easier for us to report this data. Also, we're updating our contract forms and our general conditions so that we can require each of the contractors to report MWESB activity within each of our projects, and also updating our contracts and RFPs so we can improve our outreach efforts. So the next steps we have is to present an MWSB policy at the State Board of Higher Education when we meet in June. And our goal is to be more responsive to each of the communities that we serve in Oregon. And in the last page of my handout, I've also included the 10 largest contracts within the system of our seven universities. For the most part, they're Oregon companies. There's a couple there that, I mean, although they have a huge presence in Oregon, they're not Oregon-based, like Turner Construction. So with that, I entertain any questions you may have.
Question. I have one on the Matthew Knight Arena in Eugene, and that's a huge project.
Yes,
and it the others pale in comparison, but I'm surprised that in Eugene they could only get 4%. If you drilled down deeper into that, and Hoffman, depending on the site, has often done better. In fact, even if you look at these numbers at Western, they did okay. But do you know what was going on there?
Senator Shields, the problem is we don't have a strict quota or guideline to say 4% is not good, 4% is good. in the future, our RFPs will have in them a selection criteria that will points will be awarded based on past performance and what their current goal for each project is. So yes, we can do better. No question there.
Do you happen to know if, since ODOT's already doing a disparity study and investing money in that, presumably a significant portion of that is from federal dollars, can the other state agencies just piggyback off of ODOT's disparity study since they're, you know, construction generally? Do you know if that's legal?
Senator Shields, we have inquired with our Department of Justice to see if we can piggyback off other disparity studies because they are very expensive to do. And I believe the answer is yes, we can do that if the construction that the studies have looked into are related to the construction we are going to do. So we may be able to piggyback on that. That hasn't been resolved yet.
Okay. All right, great. Senator George.
I'm not trying to be funny, but when I read your chart here, when I think of minority-owned businesses, I think of people who just basically need to start, that they're not poor, slow, or expensive. They're fast, good, and cheap. They're just owned by people that maybe not have had an opportunity to use their capital in a way to enter the market. So I'm trying to figure out when you say it's been a shift in priorities. It seems like to me that you can hold any minority-owned business to the same standards of delivering a high-quality product in a very timely way and low expensive, and they'll perform as long as they have the opportunity to bid that. So that's my first comment. And then the question is, I'm assuming that I'm going to take the social quality issue away because I think that they do that. How has this been driven this direction then so that we're not focused on good, fast, and cheap, but some other factors that may be delivering less to the taxpayers for the same dollars? I mean, who's driving that train? Because I've never really felt that from legislature. We want things done quickly, done well, and done inexpensively. So, and I don't think engaging minority-owned or women-owned businesses conflicts with that goal. So if you can talk to me a little bit, I'd appreciate that.
Chair Shields, Senator George, you're correct. These pieces all are interrelated. There are minority contractors that can operate good, fast, cheap. But it's in the last several years in the construction industry, we've been more aware of sort of the environmental impacts of our construction. What do we do with the construction waste? We just throw it into the landfill, or do we reuse it? Do we build buildings that are inefficient? No, we want to look at how can we make best use of the state's money. We want to have very efficient buildings that use less resources than we previously had built. We tend to hold on to our buildings longer than most agencies, and certainly more in the private industry. We have buildings that date back to the 1850s. But what we're trying to do is provide a sustainable building, knowing that we can't just go out there and ignore the social equity piece. We do have to provide family wage jobs to the entire community, not just select few. So that it's just the perception that our priorities have shifted. We have to recognize that we have to do both. We have to be sustainable, and we have to provide a social equity component to our projects.
Follow up. I guess my question would be, is that quantified in a dollar, so in a dollar figure? So is there a cost-benefit analysis done when you start talking about some of these things? Is there a cost-benefit analysis done as far as when we're doing a construction project so that I know what the environmental or other type of consideration is adding to the total project cost? I mean, is that ever...
Yeah.
Quantified in that.
Yeah, Chair Shields, Senator George, when we first started adopting the LEED Silver policy, it was probably a 10% added cost to do that. As we've developed the industries in Oregon, where the design professionals and the contractors have learned how to make the buildings more efficient, that cost has come down. And we're now seen as the leading experts in the country, so where we can take that technology to other states and show that how we've succeeded in doing that type of construction. So we have many examples within the system that are LEED Platinum or LEED Gold of how, for instance, at Oregon State, we have the first LEED power or LEED certified energy center in the country. That's a definite economic development aspect of Oregon, having that experience and technology to be able to do those kind of projects here.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Great. Well, thank you very much for your testimony.
Sure.
And I just wanted you all to know that we may have you all come back before the end of the legislative session. And because what we're really interested in is not saying you're not doing a good job, but we want you to put points on the scoreboard. And so we might invite you, we might invite some of your top contractors to come back and tell us what they've done on their projects. And because we're interested in making sure that, as much of this money as possible stays in Oregon and that everybody has an equal shot. I'd like to bring up our next testifier, Maurice Romming. He is the president of O'Neill Electric. Maurice has been a union electrician for over 20 years, and since 1998 he's been the president of O'Neill Electric. He's the current treasurer of the National Association of Minority Contractors and the president of the Oregon chapter. O'Neill Electric was established in 1998. Since then, it has grown to over $10 million in annual sales. He has 40 electricians in the field working throughout Oregon and Washington, and has gotten contracts throughout the federal government's GSA, Mercy Corps headquarters, Patton Park Apartments, Bonneville Spillway Power and Distribution Upgrades, I-205 Duct Bank Installation, and the VA Portland Imaging Remodel. Mr. Romming, welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you, Senator Shields. One of the things I'd like to say is we heard a lot of conversations about not knowing all the data. We heard conversations basically talking about the general contractors, and one of the things I'd like to say is just starting off is that we're not poor, slow, or expensive.
that was my point.
we are very qualified contractors. National Association of Minority Contractors has a pool of qualified, experienced contractors to pay a livable wage. We like to feel like the small businesses are the generator of jobs, and so by utilizing us, we hire actually the information about the 40 employees that we have. We're closer to 60 now, so we are growing, and we actually have jobs on the Oregon campus except the university campuses. Unfortunately, they're for the first department that's willing to give us a $4 million contract. We haven't had really good luck working with the agencies locally. Federal agencies, there was some conversation earlier about GSA and GSA schedules. We work for GSA. GSA nominated us recently for an award, but we have not done anything with DAS. And so there is a disconnect. I think one of the corrections, one of the ways that we can correct this disconnect, and I hear this amongst all our members too, our members say, we would like to do work with ODOT, we would like to do work with the agencies, but they feel like there's barriers that are in place. Many of them have been removed by the disparity study, and so we feel one of the key things is to look at how either they could piggyback, go jointly, but having a disparity study done will give that information that everyone is seeking, and that is how can we engage the minority community so that they actually are participating on our projects, generating those jobs, and I think a disparity study will give the recommendations for that. I also feel like we should also have an implementation plan so that if the disparity study does come out and says these are the things that can increase utilization for local contractors, local minority, women-owned contractors, and small businesses, that actually is adhered to and not one or two of the items on the disparity study be adhered to or just one. I think it's a waste of resource if we do have a disparity study and it's not implemented to its fullest extent. I'm happy to take any questions.
You mean the recommendations of the disparity study need to be fully implemented? Is that your point?
Exactly, Senator.
Okay. Senator Boquist.
I just want to echo what Marie said here. I mean, we study things to death in the state here, and, you know, it's the same with the committee. Once we find something out, if we don't act upon it and change the law and change the way people have been doing the lack of business in the past, we're not going to be successful.
Yeah. Could I ask someone from DAS to come up too? One thing that I've been reading about is the challenge when you do kind of an Oregon preferred model, not just the threat to reciprocity, but that you might also bump into trade agreements, and that a complaint could be filed with the World Trade Organization. Is that something that also DAS is to keep track of?
Senator Shields, members of the committee, I'm not sure what in terms of keeping track, but yes, there are many international trade agreements that the state as a subfederal unit is subject to. Whenever we have a question in my office, we go to the Department of Justice because these finding out what does apply, what doesn't apply, can be pretty daunting. And so I would turn to them to ask for specific help in a particular area, because, again, the federal government, there are different agreements that have aspects that impact, say, construction or impact other goods and services. So, again, I go to them for help.
Yeah, but it is something that we need to be careful about.
Yes, Senator, we do.
Senator George.
So I want to ask you kind of a question logistically of how this is working. I have a friend of mine who started a construction firm, was kind of successful before the economic downturn, and then as people started coming in with bids on almost every project, large firms that were heavily capitalized and established were using their capital to, in essence, bid below cost. And so it was hard for a new startup firm or a undercapitalized firm to compete, especially during the dip, because they couldn't really, in essence, buy contracts to keep working. On the flip side of that is, so the question I have to ask you is that when you're not getting a bid, when minority-owned businesses, in your experience, are not getting awarded contracts, is it because of some economic factor and there is some cost, or is there something that we can actually do as legislators to encourage? Is it like the, what I fear, I guess, is one of the things we heard about is there's points awarded for experience, right? And I don't know how much that's being weighted for new incoming firms into the competitions. So how do you ever get awarded experience awards if you never awarded a contract? So I'm trying to figure out exactly when your firms go in, from your association go in and they're not awarded a contract, is there any kind of analysis that you folks are doing saying, okay, here's why the firms aren't getting the contracts, and here's how either the law can be changed or the process can be changed that would award more contracts to women-owned or minority-owned firms. From your perspective, what's causing that blockage?
Well, one of the things that I would say is that what's causing the blockage is, in the disparity studies, actually, the previous one that ODOT did actually had some pretty good recommendations to correct some of those. There is those larger contractors that can potentially buy a project. So then it automatically keeps us arms away from being able to participate. Certain language that, you know, you heard the RFP where you provide points. But there's other ways also is to look at those larger contractors and those larger subcontractors and having them engage in a plan. And so by them saying, okay, when I've seen the successful with many of the conversations with the Hoffman, what they do is they go to their subcontracting base and they say, we want you to diversify. We don't want to carry the diversification all by ourselves. And so then they have to reach out to those communities that were left out, and now they're involved in the projects. And I think that's one of the corrective measures that can happen in order so that we can have more participation, not just looking at the one general contractor, but looking at his team and saying, or her team, and saying, where can we reach out to different other minority contractors, women contractors, and emerging small businesses. That allows them to participate, get the skill set they need to be able to then bid on their own and learn some of that.
Rizzi, do you get a sense that this is a capital problem where you actually have people bidding contracts, more of a relationship problem where perhaps some of our minority-owned firms in Oregon don't have the relationship with some of the subs, so the subs trust to award the contract to them. You see what I'm saying? Like, is there something we could do? I mean, if it's a relationship thing, you can kind of build some bridges that way. If it's a capital thing, it makes it a little tougher for us because, in essence, then what you're asking somebody to do is pay a higher price for the same service. And so trying to get at where you think where the issue is. And when there's an economic downturn, this is the most difficult time to address these issues because people are claiming that it's a cost factor. And I understand it. It's just we've got to figure it out.
I think it's a relationship thing, and I also think that whenever you're asking a contractor or subcontractor to give up a piece of pie so they have 100% of it, and now you're saying we want you to reach out to an emerging small or minority-owned business and give 10%, they're looking at why do I want to give 10%? So I think it's to be able to, I don't think it's a cost. I think it's that relationship, and also being able to say if you want 80% of the pie, you have to include 20% per se for emerging minority businesses. I don't see that happening, so if they tend to not reach out to us equitably in order to engage us because it's not in their best interest as far as on their bottom line.
Thank you. And so you said that a disparity study can kind of give the owners and the primes the foundation for and the rationale for going out and doing that kind of outreach. And then do you think, I mean, part of the problem is how do we do anything in statute or law to give preference to Oregon companies, because that's what we as a legislature, we want to see more of these dollars staying here. Can a disparity study help affect that as well?
I think a disparity study can help that, and I think that you should also look at sustainability. If you looked at the Green One the Y building, and you look at some of the projects there just related to sustainability, goods and services have to be purchased within a certain radius. So I think, we live in a very sustainable state. So I think that by identifying it and saying, okay, we're going to look at our projects. We had mentioned about LEED certified projects. Also that goes with that same sustainability. So if you want to increase the utilization of local firms, then you want to look at sustainability practice in construction, and that will restrict that pool of potential contractors to local contractors, which I think we would all like.
Senator Boquist.
Just a comment. Last session, SB 872, which I sponsored on behalf of the steelworkers, was in fact a Buy Oregon First, and we overcame the interstate commerce issue, we overcame the GATT issues, all of that, and in a nutshell, we didn't move the bill for political reasons. And so a lot of the studies, a lot of the stuff on our side in the legislature in terms of deciding, do you want to have an Oregon preference, that groundwork's been done by legislative council, the opinions are already out there, and it comes back, I think what Murray says, is if you have a wider opportunity for Oregon businesses are all small businesses, mm-hmm. and therefore you're also going to have more minority businesses that are involved. It's changing the attitude within our own entities that, small may be better, and you don't have to approach it purely in terms of smaller or more expensive. Because what we have found in the last session in the study is that if you take a mega corporation, some on these lists, and they bring their outside work in, they do the work and they leave. If you turn around and go to legislative revenue and say, okay, now tell us what if Maurice's company did this versus they did that, the economic impact in the state of Oregon is much different because Maurice pays taxes here, mm-hmm. and his people buy goods and services here. And so you can quantify those costs and analysis in the 21st century here and say, hey, the lowest technically qualified bidder providing the greatest rate of return to the state of Oregon is this guy versus that guy.
Yeah, your point's well taken. That's exactly why I wanted to have this discussion in the committee formerly known as Small Business Protection. Any other comments? Great. Thank you very much,
thank
Mr.
you.
Rumming. And we do appreciate all the departments coming forth with that information. We look forward to receiving the follow-up information, and as I said, what the main thing we want to do is to see you all do better, and anything that we can do to be supportive in that endeavor, we want you to do, and I'm very sincere when I make that statement. But we will see how many points you get on the scoreboard between now and June 30th, and this meeting's adjourned.